Looking back on the week that was with a razor wit, irreverent humour and profound political and cultural insights, this is the James McPherson Show.
Health officials working in Woketoria's hotel quarantine program were not trained in gender-neutral pronouns, an inquiry into the operation has heard. Everything I know about COVID-19 came from a cisgendered white male who only taught us about infection control, Max Koff, who worked as an officer of the Department of Health at one of the hotels used for quarantine, said in a statement. He said he received no instruction on how sexual orientation or gender identity should be considered when managing hotel quarantine. The entirety of our training was to do with health protocols, a tearful Mr. Koff told the inquiry. No other training or induction was given prior to commencing my first shift or subsequently. When asked if this had contributed to flaws in the quarantine process, Mr. Koff told the inquiry, "Absolutely. It was almost impossible to order infected patients back to their rooms when we weren't sure which pronoun to use." Mounting evidence of the failures of the state government-run program that unleashed Woketoria's coronavirus second wave played out at the inquiry on the weekend. The inquiry heard tales of lax diversity training and a security guard who was allowed to work despite having no idea about how structural racism made some ethnic groups more likely to contract the virus. The inquiry had previously heard that 99% of Woketoria's current cases of COVID-19 could be linked to outbreaks at hotels used to quarantine returning overseas travellers. Mr. Koff told the inquiry it was a mistake to quarantine people in hotels that lacked gender-neutral toilets. "The whole atmosphere was generally very non-inclusive," he said. "Frankly, I wasn't surprised when the virus escaped into the wider community." Lockie Uppy, who was employed as a quarantine security guard after responding to an ad on Tinder, said he was surprised at the lack of training he received. "There was a lot of talk about masks and gloves and proper sanitation," he said, "but we were given zero information about the climate emergency. I thought they would have had time for at least one training module on how the burning of fossil fuels affects the spread of the virus." He said he quit in disgust on June 18 as Woketorian schools were reopening, telling the inquiry, "I didn't want to be the guy who knows nothing about intersectionality when the kids at my daughter's primary school are all over it." Another witness, known only as Non-Binary Security One, said he received infection control training before starting work but was ignored when he expressed concern that the security team contracted to keep people in isolation lacked diversity. "I counted one trans person, three queers and a couple of pansexuals, but not a single Indigenous person working security on the fourth floor of the hotel where I was stationed," he told the inquiry. "We already know that COVID-19 affects blacks in disproportionate numbers. It would have been nice if the security team had reflected that." Woketorian Premier Dan Andrews expressed shock at revelations from the inquiry. "We have been emphasising equality and diversity over quality and assurance for most of my time in office, so I really cannot understand how this has happened," he said. Welcome to the James McPherson Show. Great to have your company for episode 8. If you've not heard all the other episodes, do go on to the Good Source podcast and have a look at episodes 1-7. You'll really enjoy them, but I really am glad for your company today. Well, Victoria, the state where, because of government ineptitude, the coronavirus has gotten out of control. But don't worry, the Victorian state government have a new weapon. They've figured out how to beat coronavirus. It's with Kath and Kim. Not content with locking citizens in their homes and destroying their livelihoods, the Victorian government has now employed television's most dim-witted character to lecture them about their behaviour. An advertising campaign was launched at the weekend featuring comedian Magda Sabansky as the moronic Sharon from Kath and Kim, telling Victorians, "The sooner we obey the rules, the sooner this will all be over." The ad, which is about as funny as being fined by police for visiting your mum on Mother's Day, shows Sharon playing a game of netball against herself. Let me play the audio for you and you can have a listen.
Oh, 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 I tell you what, I am so over this lockdown. Playing netball against yourself is not all it's cracked up to be, especially when you still can't even win. But you know what? It's not the lockdown that's the enemy, it's the virus. And the sooner we obey the rules, the sooner this will all be over and we can get back to the stuff that really matters. Netty. Subbing myself back in now. Oh no, Sharon, you're hopeless. I am not hopeless. I'm the most valued member of this team.
Did you get that? I tell you what, I'm so over this lockdown. Sharon huffs. Playing netball against yourself is not all it's cracked up to be, especially when you still can't even win. This, of course, is hilarious. Obviously, the Andrews government expects voters, having momentarily forgotten that they are banned from travelling more than 5 kilometres from home or from being out after dark, to be rolling around on their sanitised floors laughing uncontrollably through their face masks. But then comes the serious part. The moronic Sharon looks down the camera and tells Victorians in a serious voice, "But you know what? It's not the lockdown that's the enemy, it's the virus. And the sooner we obey the rules, the sooner this will all be over and we can get back to the stuff that really matters." Cue for long pause for comedic effect. Now, of course, we all think she's going to say something like employment or visiting family or getting back to church. But instead, Sharon says Netty, which is side-splittingly funny because we all thought she was going to say something that really mattered. And on top of that, netty is such an amusing word for netball. So the gag works on more levels than a hotel quarantine security guard. She finishes the video by subbing herself back into the game, claiming she is the most valuable member of the team. Honestly. But Victorian bureaucracy, they love it. Victoria's chief health officer, Professor Brett Sutton, took time out from battling the pandemic to tweet about the advertisement. "Nice work, Shaz. From Bretty, Bretty Bretty," which is just too funny because Bretty, of course, is one of the other Kath and Kim characters. Well done to the Victorian Chief Health Officer. The Victorian Police Twitter account sent out a message saying, "You'll always be the MVP to us, Sharon," by which we presume they meant most valuable propagandist. I haven't checked the Stage 4 restrictions small print, but with the way things are in Victoria right now, it's quite possible that police are going door to door to make sure people are laughing. And why wouldn't you laugh? What could be funnier than your government filming someone doing an activity they've banned you from doing and then charging you for it? The commercial, of course, drew sharp criticism, as you would expect, both of the Victorian Premier and of comedian Magda Sabansky. Sabansky defended the ad on Twitter, saying, "I wrote the script and I stand by every word of it. And if your side, that's the Liberals, was in government and you asked me to do a science-based public health message, I would not hesitate to help." What seems lost on Sabansky and certainly on the Victorian government is that it's galling to be told the sooner you obey the rules, the sooner you'll be allowed out of home detention by a government whose own bungling has spread the virus. And even worse, when the tut-tut message is delivered by the stupidest character on Australian television. It implies that the long-suffering public, whom Premier Andrews has repeatedly blamed for spreading the virus, are even stupider. It's patronising and it's misguided. Climate grief is a thing. I'm not joking. Climate grief is overwhelming many Australians who now suffer from eco-despair because of global warming, the ABC has warned. The National Purveyor of Climate Doom published an article last week warning that constant reporting of doom was creating a sense of doom that could leave many Australians feeling, well, doomed. ABC health reporter Paige Cockburn wrote, and I quote, "Feeling miserable, anxious, helpless, and just generally terrible because the world is becoming less habitable? You're not alone. Climate grief, or eco-despair, is a strong psychological response to the current and future loss of habitats, species, and ecosystems. It's recognised by the Australian Psychological Society, and sufferers may feel emotions like fear, anger, guilt, shame, grief, loss, and hopelessness." End quote. Returned veterans suffering from PTSD will be heartened to learn that a bunch of activists know just how they feel because, well, CO2. Of course, the best remedy for climate grief would be a strong dose of empirical scientific evidence. Failing that, teachers and politicians could stop trying to create an environment of hysteria, or we could simply defund the ABC. But since those options are about as likely as a Tim Flannery climate prediction coming true, what to do with the growing number of traumatized people racked with guilt and shame every time they switch on a light? How do we help good people who can't even start their car engine in the morning without hearing in the back of their mind an angry Swedish teenager chiding them?
How dare you?
Fear not. The Australian Psychological Society has devoted much of its website to helping people cope with climate change distress. The Society warns that failure to process the feelings of grief or guilt about climate change could lead to people being overwhelmed and unable to function in their everyday lives. This could explain why Greens like Adam Bandt and Sarah Hanson-Young make so little sense. Emotional wrecks are unsuitable for involvement in public debate. The website recommends climate change warriors consider, quote, having a day job that is separate to your activist work in order to avoid sinking into a fully fledged eco-funk. Imagine that, getting a job. But if getting a job sounds a bit extreme, another coping strategy for those burdened by, quote, the existential threats to civilization as we know it, is to take what the Australian Psychology Society calls a doona day. Because, you know, sometimes you just need to lay in bed while the planet burns. And besides, it beats getting a job, right? Other coping strategies are to, and I quote, watch a fire, gaze at a waterfall, or pick flowers without exerting additional effort. If this fails to take your mind off polar bears stranded on ice blocks, then the website encourages you to, quote, let yourself have a cry from time to time. Quote, some people find that expressing their sadness by crying can be a relief. It is sad that our planet is struggling to cope with overpopulation and overconsumption. These feelings are real, so let them out, the website advises. Dr. Tristan Snell, a counselling psychologist and researcher in environmental psychology at Deakin University, told the ABC that, quote, there's no ritual around loss of environment. He said, when you lose someone, there's a funeral and all sorts of ways people connect, and this helps process that loss. It's just not the case for loss of environment. What does he want us to have, a funeral for the earth? Someone might like to advise Dr. Snell that the earth is still very much alive. When you want to hold a funeral before the patient has even died, you really are in a bad way psychologically. The ABC article, of course, laments the fact that, quote, no research on climate grief among Australian Indigenous people exists. Well, no doubt it will be done, because everything, even eco-grief, must be viewed through the prism of race. Black climate grief matters. But it probably won't be done until research on climate grief among, you know, the two-spirited genderqueer trans women is first completed. While it's all very well for the ABC to publish articles to assist snowflakes afflicted by climate torment, what about the acute sense of grief and loss the rest of us feel, knowing our taxes are used to pay someone to write this stuff? Humans survived a supervolcano eruption 74,000 years ago, according to an article published in Science Alert magazine. According to the magazine, the eruption of the Mount Toba supervolcano 74,000 years ago choked the planet in a volcanic winter for up to a decade. But the archaeological record suggests that Toba's epic outburst did not disrupt people's lives. Research scientist Eric Fisher from Arizona State University told the magazine, "What we found was that during and after the time of the Toba eruption, people lived at the site continuously, and there was no evidence that it impacted on their daily lives. If anything, evidence of human activity in the area actually increased after the super eruption." The Science Alert article was published back in March 2018, but has been promoted in the past week to encourage people that if our prehistoric ancestors could survive a supervolcano, we can make it through the Democratic primary, through the COVID pandemic. The article didn't say how people survived the supervolcano, but there's a good chance they wore masks and self-isolated in caves while practicing hand sanitation. Speaking of supervolcanoes, get ready for the left to blow their tops in epic proportions when Donald Trump is re-elected in a couple of months. But the Science Alert piece does make a good point. Nature has always thrown challenges at people, and people have always adapted and survived. Then again, this COVID thing is starting to make everybody feel depressed. So with apologies to James Taylor and his wonderful song, I've Seen Fire and I've Seen Rain, by popular demand, here we go, a song about COVID. Just yesterday morning, they let me know our freedoms were gone. 2020, the bats they ate put an end to you. Now I'm in quarantine, and I wrote down this song. I just hope I haven't got the Chinese flu. I've seen fire and I've seen rain, but nothing like this damn COVID thing that I fear will never end. 8 p.m. curfew times and you can't even visit a friend. No, I don't think I'll see a Victorian again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? This is more than I can stand. Do I have to wear this mask another day? I'm using sanitizer, constantly washing my hands. Experts say I won't make it any other way. Oh, and I've seen fire and I've seen rain, but never travel restrictions that I fear will never end. I had a barbecue and got reported to police by a friend. But it's good to see people in Wuhan are having pool parties again. Been walking my mind to an easy time before COVID begun. Lord knows where this virus blows, it'll turn democracy around. Now there's a line of experts on the television to talk about restrictions to come. Sweet dreams of 2020 in pieces on the ground. Oh, and I've seen fire and I've seen rain, but never travel restrictions that I fear will never end. I had a barbecue and got reported to police by an idiot friend. And I'm sick of seeing our state premier on TV one more time again now. Don't want to see you one more time again now. Don't want to see you. What will you stop me from doing now this time around? Don't want to see you. Don't want to see you. Don't want to see you. Here's the premier now. Blah, 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 blah. Joe Biden has been tweeting, pitching for people's vote in the lead up to the November US presidential election. He tweeted, "I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us instead of the worst. I will be an ally of the light instead of the darkness. And we will once again be united in our love for America and for each other." And then he tweeted this: "Love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. Light is more powerful than darkness. This is our moment. This is our mission. Love, hope, light." Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for Platitude of the United States. Labor might need to split into two separate parties if it is to represent workers as well as inner-city poodle-pulling latte sippers, according to senior ALP politician Joel Fitzgibbon. All right, admittedly, Mr. Fitzgibbon didn't quite put it like that, but he was clear that Labor would struggle to represent both workers and the privileged, tertiary-educated, public sector-employed elites who sneer at them whilst riding on their backs. Okay, the Shadow Minister for Agriculture and Resources didn't exactly frame it in those terms, but he was alluding to how difficult it was for Labor to win the hearts of workers whilst spending all their time smooching the migrant, green and welfare vote. What I think he meant to say was that his party was having a hard time appealing to both workers and to wokesters. Here's what Mr. Fitzgibbon actually said, and I quote, "I just don't know how we reconcile the difficulty of being all things to people in Melbourne and another thing to a group of people living in central Queensland." He told the Blenheim Partners podcast, quote, "I'm very fearful about how the Labor Party will manage to juggle these two electorate bases, and I do fear that it won't be in my time, but the party might end up splitting," end quote. The National Right Faction convener of the party sounds like he fears that Labor has become so progressive they left their constituents behind, and one can't help but think he is right. Moreover, it's increasingly clear there is no pathway onto the Treasury benches from the woke left of politics. Surely the failure of the Greens to grow their brand beyond one seat in the lower house makes this abundantly clear. The working class, most of whom prefer continuity over rapid change, patriotism over national self-loathing, the nuclear family over an LGBTIQ plus alphabet soup, and local attachments over contrived diversity, could not be blamed for feeling as if the Labor Party is more likely to preach at them than to represent them. It's now clear that working class Australians sit at the bottom of the identity politics hierarchy. The constituency the Labor Party was founded on are these days derided as ignorant, racist, homophobic, patriarchal by the very people trusted to represent their interests. Oil and water. Mr. Fitzgibbon's warning comes as opposition Treasury spokesman Dr. Jim Chalmers prepares to visit the Queensland town of Warwick, where he will reportedly argue that climate change isn't some inner city preoccupation. No doubt the people of Warwick will be excited to hear that it's also a United Nations preoccupation, but I digress. It'll be interesting to see how Labor's plan to win back regional Queensland with a speech from someone with a PhD in the Prime Ministership of Paul Keating, representing a city electorate and with a working life spent entirely in politics, actually goes for them. If Dr. Chalmers can convince workers that it's possible to leave their mining jobs for a career in renewables without being worse off, all whilst saving the planet, he might then explain that Father Christmas is real and the Tooth Fairy. But back to Mr. Fitzgibbon. What is hilarious about dividing the ALP so as to offer voters a choice between Labor and Labor is that the ALP already has a branch that panders to progressives. They're called the Greens. The Greens will never preference the Liberal Party, so while Labor continues to push left in a bid to out-green the Greens whilst alienating their traditional base makes no sense. But then, leftism never did make any sense. Mr. Fitzgibbon's observation that workers and wokesters are mutually exclusive predictably led to many on Twitter insisting he was unfit to remain in the Labor Party. And he is, but not for promoting fossil fuels, for espousing too much common sense. This year has been a bad year for Goodyear. Up until this year, Goodyear knew what their business was, making tyres. And that's what they've been doing since 1898. But 122 years after Frank Seiberling started the iconic tyre brand, Goodyear tired of making tyres and decided to enter the exciting world of virtue signalling. Goodyear has operated successfully for more than a century without needing a diversity training seminar. For 122 years, blokes have come to the factory, made tyres, and gone home. Some of the blokes were white, some were black, some were Asian, and some were straight, and some were gay, and some were probably women. But none of that mattered because they were just making tyres. It's not rocket science, it's tyres. It's pretty simple, You fashion bits of rubber into circles that fit easily onto car and truck wheels. And Goodyear have been pretty good at it. Very good, in fact. But in 2020, the whole world went mad. Everything is political, including the wheels on your car. And so the bosses at Goodyear decided they needed to hold a diversity training seminar so that their workers would be more focused on difference whilst trying to work toward a common goal. I will never understand why organizations hold diversity training seminars. Diversity training does nothing to help a company achieve its aims, but it does serve to highlight differences between staff members and so divide them against each other. A diversity training seminar excites the social justice warriors on your staff, giving them license to start agitating for their view of utopia in the workplace. And at the same time, it outs everyone else who, you know, just wants to make tires and doesn't care for all this woke stuff. But they're outed as being dinosaurs and homophobes and racists and whatever. And before diversity training, they were just blokes making tires. But now they're part of the problem who need to be re-educated or retired. No pun intended. And so it was that Goodyear's diversity training notes and audio found their way to the media. A worker who didn't like the wokey seminar leaked a PowerPoint slide from the diversity training that listed what was and was not acceptable at the Goodyear factory. Under the heading acceptable was Black Lives Matter, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender pride. Under the heading unacceptable was Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, and any Make America Great Again attire or politically affiliated slogans. So at Goodyear, if you wear a Black Lives Matter shirt while making tires, you're creating an inclusive workplace. But if you wear an All Lives Matter shirt while making tires, you're perpetuating hate. And you can make tires for police cars, as Goodyear does, but if you make tires for police cars while wearing a Blue Lives Matter shirt supporting police, well, no, you can't do that. You can promote Black Lives Matter, a group that advocates for destruction of property, taking other people's belongings as a form of reparations, killing or maiming police officers, wide open borders and the complete upheaval of the social construct. And you can promote gay and lesbian and trans pride, which seeks to redefine the family, rewrite school curriculum and weaponize anti-discrimination law, but you can't wear a MAGA hat because that's political. As the employee who leaked the diversity training material said, if we're talking about equality, then it needs to be equality. If not, it's just more discrimination. We'll give that man a Nobel Prize. The result was that, well, the Goodyear blimp met the same fate as the Heidenberg blimp. People announced a boycott of Goodyear tires because Goodyear tires kept pulling to the left. A Goodyear spokeswoman, Melissa Monaco, put out a statement saying, Goodyear is committed to fostering an inclusive and respectful workplace where all of our associates can do their best. In a spirit of teamwork, as part of this commitment, we do allow our associates to express their support on racial injustice and other requirements. You know what? Everyone was a lot happier, not least Goodyear employees, when they were simply making tyres. In a recent interview with The New Republic, author and atheist Ian McEwan lamented the fact that atheists don't speak out more about the value of their philosophy. The implication being that their silence is evidence of apathy or even fear of persecution. McEwan, whose book Atonement was turned into a major motion picture, told The New Republic, and I quote, "I think it is important that people with no religious beliefs speak up and speak for what they value. It's a bit of a problem, the title, atheist. No one really wants to be defined by what they do not believe in. But it's crucial that people who do not have a sky god and don't have a set of supernatural beliefs assert their belief in moral values and in love and in transcendence that they might experience in landscape or art or music or sculpture or whatever." End quote. McEwan is right that atheists have a problem speaking up for what they do believe in, since by definition, an atheist is absolutely certain that there are certainly no absolutes to believe in. Atheism is, to quote G.K. Chesterton, the most daring of all dogmas since it is the assertion of a universal negative. How does one paint a positive vision, as McEwan encourages, when, as Nobel Prize-winning biologist Jacques Monod put it, man knows he is alone in the universe's unfeeling immensity out of which he emerged by chance. One of the great benefits of spiritual belief is that it has the power to help people transcend the drudgery of daily life and to be inspired by a higher calling. McEwen says that atheists need to assert that they too can transcend the here and now by way of experiencing a landscape or a piece of music or, in his words, whatever. But how does atheism do this? If the world is nothing more than a random collection of atoms bumping about together, then there's no such thing as beauty, just tiny particles playing tricks upon the human mind. It's for this reason that staunch atheist C.S. Lewis began to disbelieve his disbelief. He couldn't accept that the music of Wagner, for instance, was simply a random collection of noises. He found it beautiful. But if atheism were true, there were no such thing as beauty. All that he enjoyed and found lovely was a mirage. And that ultimately led to his conversion to Christianity. I find it fascinating that atheists who believe with Stephen Hawking that human beings are nothing more than chemical scum on the surface of the earth acknowledge the need for us to transcend anything at all. Is it not odd that chemical scum would even want to transcend? Of course, it becomes impossible to move beyond that which you assert there is nothing beyond. It's difficult for atheists to offer a vision of transcendence when they describe life, as Theodore Dalrymple did, as nothing more than a brief flowering or interlude between two eternities of oblivion. How does one create hope when one believes with Jean-Paul Sartre that we are not like paper or knives designed to fulfill a determined function? We're more like bits of flint found on the beach, which can be put to many uses without being essentially for anything. McEwen also wants to affirm that atheists do have morals. This, of course, is something that no one would dispute. The challenge, though, is the question of where these morals come from. How did Monod's unfeeling immensity produce people with a strong sense of justice? As the high priest of the so-called New Atheists, Richard Dawkins, once wrote, "There is, at the bottom of it all, no good, no evil, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music." The assertion that atheists too have morals weakens the atheist's argument that God does not exist. Surely an adherence to a higher law is evidence of a higher power. An atheist would counter that his morality is not a belief in a higher law, but rather a sense of what he himself believes to be right and wrong. And it's here that the atheist attempts to build a tower of morality on a foundation of quicksand. If morality is based on what a person believes in their heart to be true, then there is no truth or, in fact, morality, only opinions. The Nazi vision of morality is no more right or wrong than our vision of morality. It's all just opinion. And so the atheist takes a stand for morality with his feet firmly planted in midair. Aldous Huxley understood this well when he admitted in his appropriately titled Ends and Means that, and I quote, "I want this world not to have meaning because it frees me to my own erotic and my own political pursuits," end quote. Chairman Mao's attitude towards morality is incredibly instructive in this regard as well. Mao, who presided over the communist state of China, where atheism was the official philosophy, said, "I do not agree with the view that to be moral, the motive of one's actions has to be benefiting others. Morality does not have to be defined in relation to others. People like me want to satisfy our hearts. Of course, there are people and objects in the world, but they are all there only for me." The morality of the atheistic state allowed more than 70 million Chinese citizens to die during 27 years of peacetime. McEwen is right that atheists have morals, but without a belief in God, their moral code is based upon nothing greater than their own fancy and whim. Leading evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould, in his closing statements for a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation documentary called The Nature of Things, said, "Now that we know we are not made in anybody's image, we are free to do whatever we wish." As the prolific journalist Malcolm Muggeridge pointed out, if God is dead, then someone is going to take his place, either megalomania or erotomania, the drive for power or the desire for pleasure, the clenched fist or the phallic, Hitler or Hugh Hefner. McEwen laments the fact that atheists are reluctant to speak out about the redeeming features of their philosophy. Are they really reluctant, or have they just realized there is, in fact, not much to say? Well, that concludes the James McPherson Show for this week. Thanks for your company. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you can hear my show every week. You need to subscribe to the Good Source podcast. You can subscribe to the Good Source. That's S-A-U-C-E, the Good Source podcast. You can subscribe on whatever platform you normally use to listen to podcasts. Go on and give it a 5-star rating and check out our website, goodsource.news, for articles, opinion pieces, and you can access a whole lot of other great material there by Lyle Shelton, Dave Pello, Mark Powell, and a whole lot more. So thanks for your company, and I'll look forward to being with you again next Tuesday.
The Good Source is amplifying leading conservative voices from Australia and New Zealand. Together, we're providing viewers and listeners, as well as readers, diverse formats and a better source of news and opinions, without the constant victim-oppressor, social justice warrior rhetoric, or PC fear of reality. You can help us grow this important initiative by becoming a supporter at goodsource.news today. The James McPherson Show is a production of The Good Source, written and presented by James McPherson. To watch, listen to, or read more media without the SJW narratives or PC fact filter, visit goodsource.news. That's good, SAUCE.news. Become a Good Source supporter for exclusive access to live and unedited interview recordings, including the conversations before and after the show.